a head start over the prefrontal cortex. Its jump first, think later nature drives our immediate reactions. The amygdala also biases the interpretations and analysis of the prefrontal cortex when it starts catching up a second or two or three later. This is the quote-unquote amygdala hijack in action. Great for raw survival, but also the source of much needless upset, overheated reactions, and painful conflicts with others. In my own relationships, and in the couples I've counseled in my office, I've seen so many runaway interactions in which A reacts to B, who reacts to A, who then overreacts to B, who then really overreacts to A, and on and on. Things go much better if you slow them down. Give yourself and the other person the gift of time. Time to take a breath or two, figure out what the other person is really saying. Allow the first waves of fight or flight reactions to pass through your body and recognize and restrain impulsive words and actions that you'll regret later. Those extra seconds before you speak help others feel less like they're on the receiving end of a rat-tat-tat barrage of words and emotional intensity. And the extra seconds give them time to reflect and be less hijacked themselves. If you need to, disengage and cool off. For example, look out the window, get something to eat, or go for a walk. You're not trying to stonewall an issue, but to settle down so you can engage it productively. Then, an hour or a day later, you can come back to it. Try not speaking or acting from anger. This doesn't mean not feeling angry. Anger is natural, and it indicates needs that don't feel met. Suppressing it usually creates more problems than solutions. Nor does this mean that you must never come from anger. I think there are times when people need anger to fight for their lives or for the lives of others. With this in mind, as an experiment, you could commit for a day to not speaking or acting from anger. I've tried this myself, and it has helped me slow down, tune into the hurt or worry beneath my anger, and then talk in a more heartfelt and less critical or pushy way. You can still feel the anger, acknowledge what you're feeling to others, and address whatever is at issue. Meanwhile, see what it's like to separate out the anger from everything else in your mind and not let it be the controlling force behind what you say or do. Pain or the threat of it comes to us all, challenging our need for safety. From time to time, fear and anger surge through everyone's mind. With the strength of calm, you can handle these currents much like a rafting guide riding a river in full flood. Key points. Two branches of the nervous system work together to keep us on an even keel. The quote-unquote rest and digest parasympathetic branch settles us down, while the fight-or-flight sympathetic branch revs us up. The pace of modern life fosters chronic sympathetic activation, which is stressful for your body, mind, and relationships. So look for regular opportunities to engage the parasympathetic nervous system, such as with relaxation or meditation. We react to imaginary or exaggerated threats to prevent ever missing a real one. It's a kind of paper tiger paranoia that creates needless anxiety, plus makes it harder to see and cope with actual threats. Look for ways you could be overestimating threats while underestimating resources to deal with them. Notice that you are basically all right, right now. Help yourself feel as safe as you reasonably can. Anger puts a lot of wear and tear on your body and mind, and it feeds conflicts with others. You can be powerful and assertive without being angry about it. Anger comes in two stages, the priming and the trigger. Try to act early to reduce the priming and respond to the trigger in proportion to it. Be careful about self-righteousness and fault-finding, and slow down interactions to prevent and amygdala hijack. Chapter 8, Motivation. Wisdom is choosing a greater happiness over a lesser one. The Buddha. Resilience is more than managing stress and pain and recovering from loss and trauma. People who are resilient are also able to pursue opportunities in the face of challenges. They are able to start doing things that are beneficial, to stop doing things that are harmful, and to keep on going day after day without getting too stressed about it. To be resilient in this way, we need to regulate the motivational machinery in our brains. So let's explore how to enjoy pleasures without getting attached to them, draw on healthy passion, and be motivated in positive directions. Broadly speaking, this chapter is about desire, an inherent feature of embodied life. We cannot end desire. Wishing that beings not suffer is a desire. Even the desire to transcend desire is itself a desire. The only question is, can we desire well? Liking and wanting. Imagine having dinner at a friend's home and stuffing yourself with a fantastic meal, including two desserts. They bring out another dessert and give you a taste and ask, "Do you like it?" Naturally, you say, "Yes, it's delicious." Then they ask, "Do you want some?" And you reply, "No, thank you. I'm absolutely full." You like, but you don't want. Now imagine someone at a slot machine putting in a quarter and pulling the lever over and over. I've watched many people in casinos, and they usually look tired and bored, hardly smiling at the occasional payoff. There's a compulsive persistence, but little enjoyment. They want, but they don't like. In other words, liking and wanting are distinct experiences. They are also distinct neurologically. As one example of this, deep inside the basal ganglia in your subcortex, a region called the nucleus accumbens contains a small node that helps regulate the sense of liking something and a separate node that regulates the sense of wanting it. The tipping point. I'm using the word wanting in a narrowly specific way in this chapter, as a state of insistence, drivenness, or craving that's based on an underlying sense of deficit and disturbance. The root of this word means lack. It's natural to like things that are pleasurable, such as a sweet dessert with friends. But issues arise as we move from liking to wanting, from enjoying a meal together to insisting on the last piece of pie. The shift from liking to wanting marks the tipping point from the green zone to the red zone, from an underlying feeling of fullness and balance to a sense of something lacking, something wrong. It's extremely useful to become aware of this transition in real time. Then you can shift back into simply liking and pursue opportunities and enjoy pleasures without adding the stress that comes from wanting. There's a saying that liking without wanting is heaven, but wanting without liking is hell. When you like something without wanting it, you're able to enjoy it fully. There's no tension around the experience, no holding on to it or fearing when it will end. In the moment, there is freedom from want. Then your beneficial experiences tend to last longer and feel more rewarding. This naturally engages the enriching and absorbing steps in the heal process, which increases the installation of the experience in your nervous system. We learn more and gain more from our experiences when we simply like them. Henry David Thoreau wrote, quote, "I make myself rich by making my wants few," unquote. There are many benefits in staying centered in liking without tipping into wanting, but it's often challenging. Consumerism is a driver of modern economies, and sometimes it seems like the greatest minds of our generation are busy devising ever more effective ways to stimulate wanting. Further, even if we turn off the TV, get off social media, and never walk through a mall, we have a brain that's designed to want what it likes. Wanting more. The innate tendencies of the mind, our human nature, are the result of several hundred million years of sculpting the brain. Competing with others for scarce resources, our ancestors evolved motivational systems that pushed them into intense pursuit of goals such as food or sex. This was good for survival, But one of the results today is a kind of inner advertising agency that tries to motivate you by routinely overselling how good it will be if you get what you want. As you weigh different choices, look forward to an event, or think about a particular goal, be mindful of the anticipated rewards your mind is forecasting. Then notice what the actual rewards turn out to be. Much of the time, they're less than what was promised. Additionally, even when the experience lives up to expectations, it ends eventually. The meal was nice, the new sweater looked good, it was gratifying to finish the project at work. But then the experience is gone. Now what? Anticipated rewards are frequently disappointing. Even the best experiences are impermanent. These two facts can create a chronic sense that something is missing, something is wanting. This pushes us to keep seeking the next shiny object, the next experience. Even when you're feeling at ease, with no problem to solve and no need for anything else, see if you can notice a kind of auto-wanting in the back of your mind, an ongoing scanning for something new to want even when you are already satisfied. This tendency may have evolved to prod our ancestors into foraging and sniffing about for new opportunities. But embedded in this auto-wanting is also an underlying feeling of restlessness and a subtle sense that the moment, every moment, is never fully satisfactory as it is. This hunger for the next thing pulls us away from appreciating what we have and toward wanting what we lack. It's poignant that we habitually seek satisfaction with a mindset shaded with dissatisfaction, which holds complete contentment always just out of reach. Liking without wanting. There are times when a person must move into a state of intense wanting in order to meet immediate needs. Some years ago, a brush fire began in the hills above our home. I knew we might be ordered to evacuate on short notice, and it was possible that our house would be threatened. I ran inside and quickly gathered up the essentials we wanted to have with us just in case. My heart was racing and the adrenaline was pumping. It was a necessary spike of red zone stress. And then it settled back down into orange, yellow, and green as we watched our fire department put out the fire before it spread any farther. Sometimes wanting is necessary, but it always comes with costs, from a subtle experience of tension and contraction to long-term wear and tear on your body and relationships. To meet life from a sense of liking without wanting, the methods that follow are really helpful. Be mindful of the hedonic tone. Be aware of the sense of experiences as being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is their hedonic tone. We like and approach things that have a pleasant hedonic tone, dislike and avoid things that are unpleasant, and ignore or move on from things that are neutral. Also be aware of the hedonic tone of the different things you imagine doing, such as planning a meeting, thinking about how to approach a difficult conversation, or deciding whether to buy something. We tend to move rapidly into wanting things that have a pleasant hedonic tone. Consequently, mindfulness of the hedonic tones of your experiences creates a space between the pleasantness of an experience and any wanting related to it. In that space, you have a choice, and you don't have to shift automatically into wanting. Explore simply liking. See what it feels like to enjoy something distinct from wanting it. Be aware of a sense of ease in your body. Observe how your thoughts remain open and flexible. Notice that you can enjoy something without adding wanting to it. Become familiar with the sense of having pleasure, savoring a meal, laughing with friends, while letting go of any wanting about it. Repeatedly take in this way of relating to the things you enjoy so that it becomes increasingly natural for you. Explore the experience of wanting. As you go through your day, be mindful of the transition from enjoyably liking something to stressfully wanting it. Be aware of auto-wanting in the back of your mind, looking for something new to want even when you already feel fine. Recognize sales pitches from your inner ad agency, which might seem like, "It will taste, feel, be so good," or, "Don't worry, just one more time," or, no one will know. Or, it will be so much fun. Then, when you do experience what you wanted, notice when it's not as good as promised. Imagine a kind of inner dashboard and notice when red lights of wanting start flashing on it. Get to know different flavors of wanting. For example, be mindful of what it's like to feel urgent, pressured, contracted, insistent, demanding, compelled, craving, or addicted. Step back and observe the elements of an experience of wanting. The thoughts and images, bodily sensations, emotions, facial expressions, posture, and actions. Notice how wanting feels different from liking. Recognize that wanting is an experience like any other, made up of parts that come and go. Try to see experiences of wanting as clouds moving through the sky of awareness. Then they don't feel so weighty and compelling. Come back to liking. The fact that wanting arises in awareness is not itself a problem. It is natural to want. The problem is that we privilege experiences of wanting and let them control us. Just because there is an experience of wanting does not mean you have to do something. The crux is not whether wanting arises, but what your relationship to it is. Recognize the costs of wanting for your health, well-being, and relationships. See if you can make a fundamental choice to engage life as much as possible on the basis of liking rather than wanting. Use the heal process to enrich and absorb the experience of this choice so that it becomes increasingly stable in you. If a like becomes a want, step back from it and label it to yourself, such as, really wanting that beer, or so revved up about proving this point, or spending too much time on this clothing website. Observe the wanting as a part of yourself that's off to the side or in the distance, perhaps imagining that it's like an amusingly insistent dog pulling you in the wrong direction. Take a few breaths to calm and center yourself. Disengage from any sense of pressure, compulsion, or must-ness. Consciously let go of wanting. Recenter yourself in enjoyment and purposefulness without wanting. Feel already satisfied. Any experience in which there is a sense of satisfaction, such as gratitude, pleasure, and accomplishment, is an opportunity to feel that this need has been met, at least for the moment. In addition to specific experiences, also be mindful of the general sense of being already full, that this moment is already enough, and try the guided practice that follows. If you repeatedly internalize these experiences of satisfaction, even mild and passing experiences in daily life, they will gradually build up an unconditional feeling of contentment deep down inside you. Then you'll carry an underlying happiness with you wherever you go. You won't get so stressed about chasing pleasures or achievements. If they come, fine. And if not, well, you're already happy. Experiential practice, feeling already full. Take a few breaths and relax. Notice that you are breathing. That your heart is beating. That you are going on living. There may be pain, illness, or disability, and there may be sorrow and suffering. And meanwhile, you can focus on what is sufficient, on what is functioning. It could be good to have more, and still, there is an enoughness already. Let the sense of this enoughness sink in. Recognize the nurturing fullness of the natural world, including its offering of oxygen to breathe and food to eat. No matter what might be missing in your life, there is still the abundance of nature. So many kinds of living things enabling you to live. Let yourself feel supported, protected, and fed by the fullness of life. Consider the fullness of the material universe. Your body consisting of countless atoms, already present, already made. Nothing you need to do to create them. The fabric of matter and energy, space and time, from which you are woven already. Rest in this fullness, not needing to understand it, simply receiving it. Be mindful of so much appearing in awareness in each moment. So many sounds, sensations, images, emotions, and thoughts. Relax and recognize the almost overwhelming inherent fullness of ordinary experience itself. Allow the sense of fullness to fill you. Recognize that it's all right that experiences keep passing away, since they are continually replaced by new experiences. Let yourself feel filled by whatever arises in awareness, even as it passes away. Already so full, let go of wanting anything more. Healthy passion. As I said in the previous chapter, the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches of the nervous system work together like the gas and brake pedals of a car. The sympathetic nervous system activates during the fight or flight stress response, but it's also engaged when we're pursuing opportunities with enthusiasm, being assertive, making love, and cheering on children and friends. We need the sympathetic nervous system for healthy passion. Just because there is a stressor, from a holiday dinner at your home to a high-stakes opportunity at work, doesn't mean you need to feel stressed. The activation of the sympathetic nervous system is not inherently stressful. The key difference is whether positive or negative emotion is also present. To put it simply, sympathetic nervous system activation plus positive emotion equals healthy passion, while sympathetic nervous system activation plus negative emotion equals unhealthy stress. Positive emotions and the green zone. To understand the relationship between emotion and stress, think about two examples from your own life. First, recall a time you pursued a big goal and there was a lot of stress involved. For instance, you might have been moving to a new city or taking on a major project. Remember some of the negative emotions you had, such as anxiety, frustration, and anger, and consider how these made you feel more stressed. Second, recall a time you went after a big goal while experiencing many positive emotions. Perhaps you felt hopeful, eager, delighted, enthusiastic, confident, or joyful. Look back and see how these feelings lowered your stress. Positive emotions keep you in the green zone as you become more active, intense, or passionate. Because the sympathetic nervous system evolved to help our ancestors fight or flee, it's easy for excitement to turn quickly into frustration or anger. For example, I remember watching the San Francisco 49ers on TV and whooping happily as they scored a touchdown, and then being flooded with irritation when my wife asked a simple question from another room. Sympathetic nervous system activation is like zooming down the highway. Going fast, you can cover more ground, but the smallest thing could make you crash. Positive emotions help you stay inside the guardrails. Finding a sweet spot. There's a sweet spot where what you're doing is challenging enough to be engaging, but not so challenging as to feel overwhelming. To find and stay in that sweet spot, try these approaches. Be comfortable with your body revving up. If you are facing a challenge and start to feel tense or nervous, tell yourself that it is okay to speed up, breathe faster, and feel a rush of adrenaline. When you interpret things in this way, as your body's healthy way of coping, they can feel less stressful. Remember that you have handled similar challenges in the past, and see how you are handling the current situation effectively. This will help you be more confident and less stressed. Prime yourself with positive emotion. Before entering a situation that could be exciting, intense, or even a little nerve-wracking, lay a foundation of positive emotion. Bring to mind good feelings and attitudes that are matched to the basic need that is at stake. This is an application of the methods in the Grow the Strengths You Need Most section in the Learning chapter. For example, if you are going to be running a meeting, call up past experiences in which your leadership was successful or your expertise was appreciated. Doing this will prime you to respond to any challenges with grace and good humor rather than tension and irritability. When you speed up, watch out for negative emotions. When you do hurry, get excited, or feel intense, keep a sharp lookout for negative emotions such as frustration or anger. It's like driving a race car under a yellow flag. Keep going, but be careful. If negative feelings come up, label them to yourself, such as irritation, worry, resentment. This will increase regulation by your prefrontal cortex and calm down your amygdala. Try to slow things down. Pause a little longer than usual before you speak. Mentally and perhaps physically, step back from the situation until the needle of your stressometer climbs down from red to orange to yellow to green again. Enjoy the journey. As you pursue a goal, look for signs of progress. Mark the small victories and notice the little accomplishments. This drip, drip, drip of mild experiences of success will be rewarding to your brain and help you stay in the sweet spot of healthy passion. For example, if my email inbox has 50 new messages, I try to feel a sense of completion as I deal with each one of them. Then the whole inbox doesn't seem so daunting. Inclining your mind. Most of us have at least a few things that we know would be good to do, but it's hard to do them. Similarly, there are things that would be good to stop doing, but we keep doing them. For example, I know I should exercise more and eat fewer carbohydrates. Even when we're moving toward the right goals, sometimes we go about it in the wrong ways. Our deepest aims are always positive, since they're grounded in our basic needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection. For example, beneath desires to eat a bag of cookies are deep aims for comfort and satisfaction. Under desires to impress others are deep aims for self-worth and connection. Most of the trouble we get into is not about our deepest aims, but how we go about achieving them. Consider a desire that's been troubling for you, perhaps for certain foods or experiences, and ask yourself, what's the deep aim at the bottom of it? And when you get the answer, ask yourself, how could I pursue this aim in better ways? When you're trying to motivate yourself toward a particular goal, or to pursue that goal in wiser ways, it's important to take practical actions to set yourself up to succeed. For example, arrange for a walking buddy to meet you each morning to get more exercise, or clear the candy out of the cupboard if you'd like to eat fewer sweets. It's useful to do these things, but most of us already know the practical actions that would set us on the path, and we're still not walking it. So, how do we get ourselves to head in the right direction and away from the wrong one? The motivational circuit. This is where a little knowledge about a key motivational circuit in your brain can be very useful. As the sense of reward in an experience increases, neurons in the ventral tegmental area at the top of your brainstem release more dopamine in two other regions in your brain, the nucleus accumbens inside the subcortex, and the prefrontal cortex behind your forehead. In the nucleus accumbens, a spike of dopamine activity sends signals through the globus pallidus and thalamus that prompt you to take action toward the rewards. In the prefrontal cortex, increased dopamine activity focuses attention on what is rewarding. It also stimulates prefrontal executive functions, to figure out how to keep the rewards coming and get even more of them. The ventral tegmental area, nucleus accumbens, and prefrontal cortex form a kind of circuit that also operates when we see opportunities and potential rewards. To put this circuit to work for you, it helps to strengthen the association in your brain between the actions you'd like to encourage and the rewards that will come from them. I'll tell you how to do this a little later in this chapter. You can also use this method to develop new ways of acting to replace old ways that you'd like to discourage. For instance, to help yourself not get heated with a provocative relative or coworker, keep focusing on what feels rewarding in staying calm and centered. You'll be extinguishing a bad habit while reinforcing a good one. Temperamental differences. As you strengthen the association between certain behaviors and their rewards, take your temperament into account. Different people have different quantities of dopamine receptors inside the motivational circuit. Neurons connect with each other at tiny gaps called synapses. When a neuron fires, it releases neurotransmitters that move across this gap toward the receptors of other neurons. Receptors are like docking stations, and neurotransmitter molecules are like little ships. They land very quickly because the space between neurons is so small that several thousand synapses could fit inside the width of a single hair. When neurotransmitters bond to receptors, that affects whether the receiving neuron will fire or not. Neurons with fewer dopamine receptors need more incoming dopamine to trigger dopamine-related activity. To simplify, the fewer dopamine receptors that a person has, the more rewards that person needs to stay motivated. Some people find it easy to stay on task and keep plugging away, even if it's not very rewarding. These people tend to have more dopamine receptors. Other people lose interest pretty quickly if something is not stimulating or otherwise rewarding. They tend to have fewer receptors. These are normal variations, one aspect of natural temperamental diversity. My guess is that as our ancestors evolved, it was useful to have a variety of temperaments in their small bands. Individuals with fewer dopamine receptors, for example, could contribute to the band by looking for new opportunities, ideas, and ways of doing things. It is not a character flaw to have relatively few dopamine receptors. It just means that a person is aided by increasing three things: the amount of reward, the attention on it, and the sensitivity to it. In fact, increasing these three things will help anyone to keep inclining the brain, and therefore the mind, in a positive direction. You can increase the amount of reward in several ways. 1. Choose activities that are more stimulating and pleasurable. For example, get exercise through playing a sport rather than jogging on a treadmill. 2. Add new rewards, such as doing an activity with other people. 3. Vary the details of what you're doing. For example, if you're shifting your diet toward healthier meals, keep trying new recipes. 4. Take frequent short breaks and then come back to the task. 5. Ask for frequent feedback, especially positive. Highlight rewards. In addition to creating new rewards, you can highlight the rewards that are already present by putting more attention on them and becoming more sensitive to them. This is worth doing in its own right, and sometimes it's not possible to create new rewards. Before doing it, pick something that you are trying to motivate in yourself. See yourself doing it, and at the same time, imagine what would be enjoyable or important about it. For example, to get myself to use my treadmill and grind uphill for half an hour, I'll imagine how good it will feel to have a break and listen to music and read something while chugging along. You can also imagine the rewards that will come in the future, after you have done the activity. When you anticipate rewards in this way, move from the idea of the reward to an emotional and embodied sense of it, which will release more dopamine. Using my treadmill example, I try to bring to mind the pleasurable, relaxed feeling I have when listening to my favorite playlist. This is a lot more motivating than just knowing intellectually that there will be music. If you've used the heal steps in the past to install the feeling of a beneficial experience, such as listening to music, then it will be easier to evoke this feeling in the present, like storing good experiences in a kind of bank that you can draw upon later. While doing it. When you are doing whatever it is that you want to motivate, repeatedly focus on what feels pleasurable about it, again and again and again. This is how to create surges of dopamine that will train the motivational circuit. Keep looking for what could be fresh or surprising about what you're doing. Dopamine spikes when the brain encounters novelty. Also, help yourself get as excited or as intense as is appropriate. This increases adrenaline, which strengthens the association between the activity and its rewards. After doing it. When you are done, take a little time to savor the results. Getting off the treadmill, I focus on feelings of vitality and satisfaction. Don't shift into the next thing without registering the rewards of what you have just done. You worked for them and deserve them. Encourage yourself. I've gone rock climbing with guides, and most of them have been very encouraging. They told me when I made a mistake, but they emphasized how I was making progress. They brought out the best in me as a climber and made me want to keep climbing. On the other hand, one fellow was very different. He climbed ahead and yanked at the rope when I slowed down at the harder sections. He pointed out all my errors of technique, but only watched impassively as I moved smoothly through a tricky traverse. His impatience and exasperation traveled down the rope like an angry scolding. Instead of making me improve, it made me self-conscious, worried, and stressed. It made me climb worse. He was an excellent climber, but a poor guide. Much the same thing happens inside a person's mind. There are basically two ways to get yourself up the mountains of life. Through guidance or criticism. Through drawing on the inner nurturer or the inner critic. Consider the differences between these two approaches. Under the heading of guidance, we have, what is the goal? What's right? A kind tone. A quality of compassion. And a sense of building up. While under the heading of criticism, we have, what is not the goal? What's wrong? A harsh tone. A sense of dismissiveness. And a quality of tearing down. As you pursue your goals, notice what it feels like to guide yourself and what it feels like to criticize yourself. Deliberately emphasize the attitude and feeling of guidance. Bring to mind people who are supportive and encouraging, and imagine how they would talk to you after you have made a mistake. Cheer yourself on. Repeatedly use the heal steps to take in experiences of self-guidance so it becomes increasingly natural for you. Many people fear that if they're not hard on themselves, they'll just goof off. But this doesn't have to be true. Try to recognize repeatedly that you can keep yourself on the high road through guidance rather than criticism. Also recognize that being critical of yourself lowers performance over time. For example, the stress of beating yourself up over what you did wrong releases cortisol, which gradually weakens your hippocampus and consequently your brain's capacity to learn from what you did right. If you know your course is good, even if it is not immediately rewarding, stay with it. This is the essence of motivation. Being able to sustain action based on knowing in the core of your being that you should do something. I once took a class on meditation from Joseph Goldstein, a precise and no-nonsense teacher. At a break, I told him what I was experiencing and asked if I was on the right track. He nodded and then smiled and said two words I've never forgotten. Keep going. Key points. Resilience is more than bouncing back from adversity. People who are resilient keep pursuing their goals in the face of challenges. Consequently, learning how to regulate your brain's motivational machinery is a key aspect of resilience. Liking is distinct from wanting. Wanting comes with a sense of insistence, drivenness, or compulsion that is stressful and can lead to harmful behaviors. Explore the experience of liking something without wanting it. repeatedly take in experiences of being already satisfied to build up a core of contentment. Then you can enjoy pleasures and be ambitious without the stress of wanting. The sympathetic nervous system brings energy and passion. But without positive emotions such as happiness and love, sympathetic activation draws us into red zone stress. When you speed up, watch out for negative emotions and keep looking for ways to experience positive ones. The brain has a fundamental motivational circuit based on dopamine activity. There are natural variations in the quantity of dopamine receptors that individuals have. People with fewer receptors tend to need more rewards to stay motivated. Train this circuit by increasing the association between rewards and whatever you'd like to motivate yourself toward. Increase the amount of rewards, your attention on them, and your sensitivity to them. People often think they need to be hard on themselves to stay motivated, but the opposite is generally true. Use guidance rather than criticism to stay on your course. Chapter 9, Intimacy. I would rather walk with a friend in the dark than alone in the light. Helen Keller. I was isolated and withdrawn as a child, and much of the time it felt like I was watching people from a great distance, as if I were on the outside of a restaurant window looking in, watching people talking and laughing together. I could see but not touch, hear but not speak. It took me a long time to get up the nerve to come in from the cold. I gradually opened up, slowly but surely knowing and being known by others, and becoming increasingly connected with them. Broadly speaking, this is intimacy, whose root meaning is to make familiar or known. There are degrees of intimacy in all our relationships, from a passing encounter with a hot dog vendor to a marriage of 50 years. Intimacy rests on a foundation of personal autonomy, empathy, compassion and kindness, and unilateral virtue. These are the topics of this chapter, in which I'll emphasize ways to work with your own mind. In the next chapter, we'll focus on ways to interact with others. Me and we. The greater the intimacy, the greater the rewards, and the greater the risks. As you open up and invest in relationships, you inevitably become more exposed and vulnerable. Then others can more easily disappoint or hurt you. How can we gain the benefits of intimacy while managing the challenges that come with it? Paradoxically, in order to get the most out of we, you need to stay centered in me. As the proverb puts it, fences make for good neighbors. A strong sense of autonomy, that you are your own person and make your own choices, fosters depth of intimacy. For example, when you feel grounded in your body, it's easier to stay open to the feelings of other people. When you take care of your needs, there's a natural receptivity to the needs of others. Knowing you can step back aids stepping in. Much as autonomy enables intimacy, intimacy supports autonomy. Close and nurturing relationships help a person feel safe and worthy as an individual, which promotes a confident independence. In a positive cycle, autonomy and intimacy feed each other. Together, they make you more resilient. The effect of personal history. When there is less autonomy, when a person feels overwhelmed, pushed around, or entangled with other people, there will be less intimacy, especially over time. But staying me when dealing with we can be hard to do. Ask yourself whether you're able to maintain a comfortable sense of autonomy when others do any of these things, such as want things from you, are upset with you, try to persuade or influence you, don't respect your boundaries, or attempt to dominate or control you. How a person reacts to challenges to autonomy depends in part on his or her temperament. There is normal variation in the priority that people place on autonomy compared to intimacy. These natural differences in sociability and extroversion compared to introversion can be seen in childhood, and they persist into adulthood. The joke about parents is that with your first child, everything seems to be about nurture, But after the second one, you realize how much depends on nature. Still, nurture what happens to you and what you do with it, starting with the first breath and continuing through the last, makes an enormous difference. Beginning at birth, you began to explore independence and individuality, such as choosing where you would look and what you would swallow or spit out, discovering that the warmth against your skin came from another body, and learning that others could have thoughts and feelings different from yours. Along the way, you naturally made messes and mistakes and sometimes got on the nerves of others. And then the world responded. Some parents, relatives, teachers, and cultures value and support a child's independence and individuality, and some do not, with a big range in between. Thousands of little episodes in which a child's self-expression and assertiveness are accepted and managed skillfully, or not, add up over time to shape a person one way or another. Think about your history and take some time to answer these questions, which focus on your experiences related to autonomy. In childhood, what did you observe around you, such as how your siblings or other children were treated when they were opinionated, upset, or stubborn? What happened to you if you acted this way? How did all this affect you when you were young? Also think about your life so far as an adult and how others have treated you. Has it felt safe to be your true self out loud? Have you needed to push down your needs to keep the peace? When you've been strong and assertive, have others been reasonably receptive or not? Growing autonomy. Then step back and ask yourself how this history might be affecting you today. It's normal to internalize how others treated you, such as limiting, suppressing, or shaming your individuality and independence, and then do that to yourself. In important relationships, consider how comfortable you are with fully expressing your thoughts and feelings, asking for what you want, trusting your judgment if others disagree with you, and standing up to others. Wherever you start from, there are many effective ways to strengthen a healthy sense of me in the midst of we. Focus on your own experience. Notice if your attention is pulled into others and away from yourself. When this happens, return to your own experience, grounded in your body. What you are experiencing is not right or wrong, justified or unjustified. It simply is what it is, and you can stay centered in an ongoing awareness of it. Imagine boundaries between you and others. Get a sense of other people being over there while you are separate and over here. You could imagine a line drawn on the ground between you and others, or a picket fence, or, if need be, an unbreakable wall of glass. Goofy as it is, I hear Captain Kirk's voice from Star Trek in my head, "Shields up, Scotty." Inside yourself, assert your autonomy. Recall times you felt determined and strong. Focus on the sense of this in your body. Deliberately tell yourself things such as, "I get to decide what's right for me," or "I don't have to agree with you," or "You and I are different and that's okay," or "I do not have to give you what you want." For practical reasons, you may have to put up with some things, such as listening to a boss ramble in order to keep your job, or smiling politely to an irritating relative at a family dinner to keep the peace. But know that you are making this choice yourself, doing the best you can according to your own values. Call on inner allies. Intimacy supports autonomy, so tune into an internal sense of others who are on your side, which will help you stand up for yourself. Think about people who like you and who honor your independence. Imagine what they might say if others were being intense, pushy, or manipulative toward you. Bring to mind the feeling of the caring committee we explored in Chapter 6. Turn up the volume, as it were, of those who support you, and turn down the volume of those who are challenging your autonomy. Empathy. Empathy is tuning into and understanding other people. When you feel grounded as me, you're more able to be empathic without getting flooded or overwhelmed. Empathy is necessary for intimacy. It helps us make sense of tone and nuance, read intentions correctly, recognize the hurt under anger, and see the being behind the other person's eyes. Then we can communicate and interact more skillfully. At work and elsewhere, empathy bridges differences in a multicultural world. It helps us feel felt, in Dan Siegel's phrase. We live in and as individual bodies, each one mortal and often suffering. Empathy is the foundation of the sense that I am not alone. Others are with me. We are in this together. We share a common humanity. Empathy does not mean approval or agreement. You can empathize with someone without waiving your rights and needs. In fact, empathy is very useful during conflicts, or in general, with people you don't particularly like. Understanding them better could help you be more effective with them. And if they sense your empathy, they could feel more heard and become more willing to hear you. Your brain on empathy. As hominids and humans evolved, they became more empathic. Today, in our very social brain, empathy is enabled by three neural systems that tune into the thoughts, emotions, and actions of others. For thoughts, behind your forehead, the prefrontal cortex enables you to understand another person's beliefs, values, and plans. For emotions, on the inside of the temporal lobes on the sides of your head, the insula gets engaged when you sense the feelings of others. For actions, in different parts of your brain, mirror-like networks activate both when you do something, such as reaching for a cup, and when you see another person doing it. In a very efficient way, these regions in your brain do double duty. They regulate your own thoughts, emotions, and actions, while at the same time helping you to understand, from the inside out, those of others. Growing empathy inside yourself. People tend to think that empathy is just there, you have it or you don't. But you can develop greater empathy, much like growing any other psychological resource. Let's start by exploring some good ways to do this, and then see how to tap into empathy when you're interacting with others. Go deep into your interior. Increasing self-awareness, especially of the deepest layers of your experience, improves other awareness. So, tune into the nuances of sensations, emotions, thoughts, and desires inside yourself. In particular, sense down into the softer and often younger material beneath the surface of your stream of consciousness. It's like seeing a leaf floating down a river. Reaching for it, you find that it's connected to a twig, and then a branch, and then a very interesting log. Also try to track rapid changes in the flow of your experience. In your brain, neurons are routinely firing 5 to 50 times a second, so a lot can happen over the course of a single breath. With practice, you will increase your granularity of mindfulness. Step out of your perspective. To become more empathic, it helps to become more comfortable with casting loose from the familiar moorings of your beliefs and judgments to enter another person's inner world. Explore what it's like to hold your views and values lightly, and to appreciate that things which seem self-evident and important to you often do not seem that way to others. Recognize the powerful impact of life experiences on other people, including the effects of their parents, culture, wounds, and stresses. Much as it's made sense for you to become who you are because of your background, what others have become because of their background makes sense as well. Pick a charged topic in a significant relationship, such as how housework should be shared, and imagine how you would approach it if you had the beliefs, values, and background of the other person. Increase your cultural competence. This means becoming more knowledgeable about and skillful with people who belong to a group that's different from your own. As a white, male, cisgender, heterosexual, American, middle-class, able-bodied, professional person, I have found it extremely useful, and I think moral, to learn more about people who are not like me. It's made me more aware of my own unconscious assumptions and biases, and more respectful of others' priorities and ways of acting. Cultural competence gives us insight into how we interpret what others say or do, and insight into how others could interpret our own words and actions. A greater understanding of different types of people helps us have more empathy for our effects on them. Tapping into empathy while interacting. In routine situations or with familiar people, it's easy to go on autopilot and let empathy fade into the background. And if others are critical or blaming, empathy tends to fly out the window. When we really need it, empathy can seem most out of reach. So it's good to develop a deliberate habit of empathic understanding when you're with other people. Pay attention. It usually takes a conscious effort to sustain attention, especially when another person has thoughts, feelings, or desires that are different from or at odds with yours. Consider how rare it is for other people to stay present and attentive to you for several minutes in a row, and how good it feels when they do. Imagine a little monitor inside your mind that pays attention to how well you are paying attention. In your brain, this involves a region called the anterior cingulate cortex. If your mind wanders a bit, that's natural. Just bring it back. Stay open. Relax your body, especially in the area of your chest and heart. Be aware of any tension, bracing, or guarding, and see if you can let go of it. If you start to feel uncomfortable or flooded as you open to the other person, reestablish a strong sense of me. You could imagine that you are deeply rooted like a sturdy tree, and that the thoughts and feelings of others are passing through you like wind through leaves. Remind yourself that you don't have to agree with or approve of anything if you don't want to, which will help you be more receptive toward other people. Track micro-expressions and microtones. Look into the other person's eyes as much as is appropriate. Notice any discomfort you may feel with eye contact. Don't be invasive, but also be willing to extend the contact for a second or a breath longer than you normally would. It's a profound way to receive another person. Research by Paul Ekman and others has shown that underlying emotions and attitudes are often revealed by fleeting facial expressions, especially around the eyes and mouth. Observe these, and also be aware of the other person's posture, as well as speed and intensity of movement. Imagine what you would be feeling and wanting if you had those facial expressions and that body language yourself. This will tend to engage the mirror-like networks in your brain that tune into the actions of others. One of the recent developments in human evolution is the ability to produce and to hear rapid and subtle changes in tone of voice. The most recent branch of the vagus nerve complex extends up into the middle ear and face, and it is a key element of the social engagement system in your brain and body. Focusing attention on the vocal tones of other people will draw on the vagus nerve complex and deepen your empathy for them. Sense beneath the surface. Try to get a feeling for the deeper needs and pains in the other person. For example, there could be fear behind aggressiveness or desires for closeness underneath a pushing away. Imagine what the person's body feels like and whether there is fatigue, illness, or pain. Try to have an intuitive sense of what might be going on deep down inside you if you were acting like the other person. Doing this will engage the insula inside your brain, increasing your empathy for the emotional life of other people. Refine your understanding. A kind of thoughtful hypothesis testing is a key element of empathy, and it draws on your prefrontal cortex. So, develop specific though tentative ideas about what's going on with the other person. Next, test your ideas by looking for evidence for or against them. For example, consider what you know about the other person's temperament and personal history. Maybe what you thought was a deliberate effort to hurt you in particular was mainly an automatic way of reacting to people in general that was acquired in that person's childhood. Then, refine your ideas to have a more accurate empathic understanding. Warming the heart. With empathy, we can have a real sense of the sorrows and joys of others. But this sense is not itself compassion and kindness, which must be added to empathy for them to be present in the moment. And, over time, we can develop greater compassion and kindness as personal traits. Truly, each of us can become a more loving individual. Besides